You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Felix Walton, toku ingoa, nō mai, haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā, kia ora. Welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 10th of February. My name is Felix and I'll be here with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Karanama. How's it going?
Not too bad, Felix. A bit here on the koe, how are you?
I'm great. And we're joined by Marcus for his third week in a row of Dear Science. How's it going, Marcus?
Yeah, this is fun. Yeah.
that sounds like you're having a great time. So coming up on the show today, on Dear Science, we're talking about QAnon, the difference between mammals and birds in a warming world, and a new spacecraft reaching Mars. Brooke was away this week, so filling in for her is David Seymour to bring us our weekly ACT Party catch-up. Karanama brings us a report on the Waitangi Day celebrations, which he paid a visit to this past weekend, and I spoke to Jen Toop from Greenpeace NZ about the impacts of synthetic fertilizer. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātui mai, you can text us on 5395 Waiamairane or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Now it's time for...
Oh wow! It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Cheers, MOTAT, and kia ora, Marcus.
Kia ora, how are you doing?
I'm great, how are you?
I'm okay. A little bit damp today.
All right. Well, first up, we've got QAnon and conspiracy theory research. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the more observant of you may have noticed a certain lack of a President Trump in America. And researchers are trying to catch up with all the information and disinformation and misinformation and how it was spread on social media, and trying to figure out what we can learn about the conspiracy theories and things like that, that basically Trump turned upside down because I think before Trump, there always could have been conspiracy theories, but they've always sort of been bubbling under, and the number of active conspirators, I guess, are usually fairly small. But Trump really turned this upside down. He put the conspiracy theories into the mainstream, and researchers are trying to figure out what the effect of this is and how they could be taken advantage of by other potential politicians, and what we can do about it. So how do we retool and rebuild and prepare for what's coming after? After Trump Mark II, or
yeah,
oh God
forbid.
Yeah, so yeah, during his presidency, obviously he regularly retweeted followers and a link to notorious conspiracy theories such as QAnon. That's one that originated about 4 years ago, and it claimed that a powerful group of Democrats and elite people in the U.S. were trafficking and abusing children.
Right.
And that Trump was the hero fighting them and to rid the country of these people. Trump never endorsed QAnon, but he repeatedly refused to condemn them or condemn the conspiracy theory, and he at least once praised its followers for their support. So there's debates in the sort of the conspiracy theory research community, and one of them is whether Trump has pushed more people into QAnon or into these sort of conspiracy theories, or whether he's just emboldened those who already believed. Yeah, in other words, they sort of feel more confident to come out of the shadows and shout louder and make their voices heard. And so there's a lot of research now. People are really trying to catch up because the spigot has been turned off. Trump has been silenced. And so it's sort of time to play catch up and look back on what's happened. And there is an increasing, because Trump was so vocal about these things, there's an increasing belief now that he not only emboldened those who already believed, but he really managed to push more people into QAnon with his sort of incessant tweeting. And obviously things came to head on the 6th of January when Trump told attendees at the big rally in D.C., if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. And he called them to march on the U.S. Capitol, and that was just as Congress was preparing to certify Joe Biden as the next US president. And sort of this false narrative about the election was a sort of a landmark opportunity for researchers to study how disinformation spreads across the internet. And the team, there's so much information out there. The teams are still sifting through all this data, but it's starting to illuminate how social media makes it possible for populist leaders such as Trump to build these constituencies and wield power. So there's one case, for example, researchers tracked false claims that Sharpie pens, those are little black Sharpie pens, given to voters in Illinois and Arizona, resulted in damaged ballots that were unreadable by voting machines. This was a conspiracy theory, and seeded by Trump's narrative about election fraud. These claims originated among his supporters on Twitter, and then were amplified by members of his own family, right-wing influencers, and others, to helping to spread the message further and bring it into the mainstream. And you may have noticed that there were all these efforts to set the record straight on Twitter and Facebook, sort of claiming, sort of attaching warning labels to prominent tweets. But they think this really failed because the narrative spread anyway, as these grassroots level sort of conspirators from lots of unverified accounts sort of just spread these stories. And what's more, the mass media picked up on a lot of these stories and broadcast them as well. So Fox News and other places, Newsmax and other places in particular, picked up on these conspiracy theories and picked them up. So the researchers are learning that really the mass media and social media are actually very, very integrated. Mm-hmm. They're not sort of two separate things anymore. And what's happened now, obviously, is Trump has been cut off. He's no longer tweeting, or at least not on the accounts that he used to have. And what's happened is really interesting is that as soon as Trump stopped, you know, so Twitter banned Trump, Facebook and YouTube and other places have suspended Trump's accounts, the conversation was almost immediately stifled. Yeah, so the team researchers analyzed networks of influential Twitter users and found that an entire section tied to QAnon disappeared virtually overnight. And so it was as if he'd built up this sort of groundswell of support, but it was on a very, very fragile foundation. And as soon as he left, or he was stifled, then everything collapsed. Mm. Yeah. And so these conspiracy theories, he obviously pushed them into the limelight, but as soon as he was gone, they went away. And researchers are still analyzing mountains and mountains of data, but it's already clear that new regulations will be needed to govern the internet, some of the tech giants, and the content their users post online to stop this happening again.
It's a very interesting phenomenon.
It sort of shows the power of like platform companies now as well, because with Trump, he no longer had to go through the middleman like the media. He could tweet directly to his followers, and I guess it shows just how influential that can be.
That's right. And it seems like what they thought they were doing by trying to control the conversation wasn't really working very well.
Mm. Mm. All right, well, next up is all about mammals and birds. Care to tell us what this is all about?
Yeah, so let's say you were either a small mammal or a bird, and you were living in an environment that was fairly arid, like a desert. And the world is warming around you. Which would you prefer to be? This is a question for you guys.
Ooh, probably be a bird.
Yeah, I think I'd want to be a bird because you could sort of leave.
Well, it's an interesting question, because obviously the world is warming, and there's been studies on how habitat is changing and how that is affecting populations of different species. And so in the early 1900s, a naturalist called Joseph Grinnell went into the wilds of California in the Mojave Desert, and he surveyed what wildlife he found. And he made very, very interesting detailed records of what he found. And now we're going back into these areas, and we're able to compare his really detailed records, which are a great record of what was existing more than 100 years ago, to what ecologists are finding today. And the Mojave has warmed about 2 degrees Celsius over the last century. And bird numbers, mammal numbers have declined dramatically. But there is some good news for one of those species. I'll keep you on the edge of your seats for a few seconds longer. So there's definitely winners and losers here. And the researchers in the last sort of 3 or 4 years definitely found that bird populations have collapsed quite markedly. So there's a new lower number of species found per sort of site in these regions. And so on average, every spot surveyed had lost more than 40% of its desert bird species over the last 100 years or so. And these are American kestrels, mountain quail, and other species. And across the board, all species were scarcer. But a more recent study led by Iowa State University found that there's a sort of a hopeful story for small mammals like rats, mice, chipmunks, and other small mammals. And it seems like although these species have declined, a bunch of them, about 27 of them, remain fairly stable. And four have actually increased in number. So that some of these small mammal species are doing better. And so they tried to figure out why. And so they spent a couple of years measuring how birds and mammals react to the heat, to the absorption of light, their fur and feathers, and try to understand what was going on here. And they fed those numbers into the data on the species and into a computer program that modeled how much heat stress an animal would be exposed to and how well it could cool itself under different temperature conditions. Now, to keep cool, birds must expend energy. Both are warm-blooded, obviously they have to regulate their temperature. Birds must expend energy by dilating blood vessels to evaporate moisture from their legs or their mouths. And the energetic costs of cooling in birds were more than 3 times higher than in mammals. Yeah, and this is because small mammals have one major advantage over birds in that they can burrow. They can take refuge underground during the hardest parts of the day. So they can sort of escape. And only mammals that find themselves in soil that's sort of really too shallow to provide much cooling, such as a species called the cactus mouse, those species suffered from the heat.
Right.
But other species actually did okay. In contrast, birds such as the kestrel, prairie falcon, are exposed to the full brunt of the heating, and they can't really get away that easily. So they can't actually fly out of the desert so easily. This is good for mammals, but it does hint at the sort of a loss of diversity in these habitats. And there's worrying signs that this may be replicated for deserts across the globe as temperatures are rising. And it's not all good news for mammals too, because they may be at risk in the future. Thin soils cover just about 2% of the deserts today, but such areas are expected to grow as deserts get more arid. And so even these small mammals won't escape.
Yeah, so it's less of a question of who benefits from warming, more so who gets fucked over the least.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. All right, so lastly, a new spacecraft has reached Mars.
Yes, so a spacecraft called HOPE arrived at Mars, I think, yesterday. And this is one of 3 missions that are going to arrive at Mars this year. It inserted itself into orbit around the planet. That involved a 30-minute burn of the spacecraft's thrusters to slow it down from 121,000 kilometers per hour, which is fairly fast, to about 18,000 kilometers per hour. So it's captured by the gravity, and it'll maneuver over the next few months into an elliptical orbit that varies from about 20,000 to 43,000 kilometers above the planet. And it's going to take lots of pictures in the ultraviolet and in the infrared and an imaging camera that will capture how dust storms start and evolve and how the atmosphere reacts to changes in space weather, such as solar storms. And they'll also shed light on how hydrogen and oxygen gases migrate up from lower atmospheres and escape into space. Scientists are very excited about this, but one thing I haven't mentioned is where this this probe came from. Obviously, it came from Earth, but who launched it? And it's not America, it's not Russia, and it's actually the United Arab Emirates in their first big planetary mission, and the first planetary mission from an Arab nation. And it's really generating a lot of excitement in the region, and scientists hope that this is going to sort of push young people in the region to get into science and these sort of thing and these sort of missions. And it is the first of three. So China's probe is due to arrive on the 10th of February. And that's the first probe from China to get to Mars. And then the US, NASA's Perseverance rover, will join on 18th of February. So everyone's basically arriving at the same time. Mm. China's mission has an orbiter, lander, and rover. NASA has a rover, I think, yes. So everyone's arriving at the same time, and this is just because of the relative orbits of Earth and Mars, and yeah. there's a sort of a sweet spot where they're closer. Mm. Yeah,
it's a big step in space exploration, though.
Definitely. Absolutely, and I think New Zealand should get in on the party too.
Yeah. all right, well, that's Dear Science. Thank you so much, Marcus, for joining us, and thank you very much to MOTAT, as always.
Thank you, MOTAT.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Bike Auckland presents Bike Crave, the Sundowner edition.
Get ready for a full noise ride from Upper Queen Street to a sunset beach party with house music prodigy champion smashing it out as the sun sets over the mighty Waitakere's.
6:30 to 10 p.m. February 13th. Bike Rave is totally free, but tickets are essential. Visit Bike Auckland on Facebook for tickets and more.
Bike Rave is presented by Bike Auckland as part of the Summer Nova series, made possible by Auckland Unlimited with help from Social Ritual.
Hey, picking up an order for Jess.
Yep, that's a quinoa salad and caramel brownie.
Perfect. I also ordered some incredible savings. Is that coming?
The savings are baked in already. Wink.
Did you just say wink?
Change the way you save with Foodprint. Download the app today, and just by ordering fresh, delicious food, you'll be helping to reduce food waste. High quality, low price, great for your wallet, great for the planet, just great food. Get your lunch on Foodprint today.
No candlelit dinners, no commercial mush. Celebrate Anti-Valentine's Day at MOTAT with fun, dancing, karaoke, live music, the Love Police, and all sorts of antics. MOTAT Anti-Valentine's, Saturday, February 13, 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets just $20 or $15 for students from motat.nz. R18.
Arcade Radio, Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
When I'm in a New York state of mind,
Arcade Radio.
Show me that you're mine, though. Alright.
For all that and a heavy dose of fine tracks, tune in to Arcade Radio. Thursday night, 7 to 9 p.m. with Mike, Jono, Eddie, Nat, and special guests every week. Arcade Radio. Only on 95 BFM.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Earlier this week, Greenpeace delivered a petition to Parliament calling for the phasing out of synthetic nitrogen fertiliser. Then, this morning, RNZ revealed that Fonterra had been dumping nitrate-heavy wastewater en masse, polluting drinking water in the areas they were dumping. I spoke to Jen Toop, a Greenpeace NZ's sustainable agriculture campaigner, about why this is so harmful. I encourage everybody at home to pay close attention to this story, as I was very surprised by just how future-defining our agricultural practices were. So yesterday you delivered a petition to Parliament calling for the phasing out of synthetic fertilizer. I suppose my first question, from someone who isn't in the know about agriculture, what is synthetic fertilizer?
Yeah, so synthetic nitrogen fertiliser is basically a chemical that over the past few decades has been used in New Zealand to really intensify dairy farming. It's basically spread onto land to grow more grass artificially than naturally would occur, and that allows more and more cows to be crammed onto the land. And when more and more cows are crammed onto the land, we get more climate pollution from those cows, and we also get more water pollution from the effluent from those cows. And on top of that, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer itself is a really big pollutant of both the climate and of water quality. So when it's applied, it emits nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas that's about 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And in New Zealand, every year, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer is emitting more climate pollution, this is the chemical itself, than the entire domestic aviation industry. So more than all of the planes flying back and forth every day in New Zealand. So it's a huge pollutant for our climate. And it's also a big water pollutant. So it causes nitrogen pollution to get into our groundwater, into our lakes and into our rivers, where it causes big algal blooms. And it also has associated with human health risks if anyone consumes that water, which is a big deal for New Zealand because a lot of our water does come from groundwater sources. So in summary, that's what synthetic nitrogen fertilizer is, and that's some of its impact.
Right. So if this is such a risky and dangerous thing, why is synthetic fertilizer so widely used over authentic natural fertilizer?
So basically, over the last few decades, New Zealand's undergone a huge intensification of dairy farming, major conversion of land from other uses such as sheep and beef or forestry or even native vegetation and put into big dairy farms. And on those dairy farms, we've really intensified. So that means basically we've stocked more and more and more cows on the land to basically create more and more milk, which gets dried into milk powder and sent offshore. And that's been done through the use of synthetic fertilizer. So we're really basically taking land beyond its natural limits using this chemical. And Dairy New Zealand, which is a lobby group for the dairy industry, and other scientific outfits have come up with a lot of studies showing that we don't actually need to use this chemical for farmers to farm profitably. So farmers can reduce the number of cows they're farming, they can eliminate the use of synthetic fertilizer, and they can use less imported feed like PKE and still farm just as profitably and in some cases more profitably without the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. Instead, they can use other ways to naturally fix nitrogen from the atmosphere to get growth and grass. And one of the reasons that we're not seeing this being taken up is because there's a huge industry around synthetic nitrogen fertilizer now. There's two companies, Ravensdown and AgriBalance. They have sales reps that are out there on farms every day telling farmers that they need to buy synthetic nitrogen fertilizer to remain profitable. We know that's not true, and we really need to see the government step in here and regulate this dangerous chemical because we know that it's damaging the environment and we know that we can farm profitably without it.
The government has previously introduced a cap on synthetic fertilizer, but Greenpeace has said that this didn't go far enough. Could you elaborate on that?
When the government did a big review over our freshwater rules in New Zealand, because as we all know, our rivers and lakes are really at breaking point. They're really polluted. We're on the brink of losing 76% of our native freshwater fish. It's just really a dire situation for our freshwater. So the government kind of reviewed the rules into that, and they identified that synthetic nitrogen fertilizer is a major problem. And they put a cap on the amount that can be used on a farm. Before that, there was absolutely no rules. You could put as much as you wanted on, which was a crazy situation. So it's good that we have a cap, but 190 kilograms per hectare per year is like eye-wateringly high. And that's more than the dairy industry is using on average anyway. There are some farms that are using up to like 400 kilograms, which is great that they will not be able to do that anymore. But the reality is that cap should have been set lower in the first place. And I think what is really needed in order to save our rivers and also make sure that we have a stable climate going forward is for the government to actually make that a sinking cap year on year, reduce that amount that can be used, give farmers time to wean themselves off this and to start employing some of those more natural techniques to grow food. But really we need to get that cap down to zero and we need to do it quickly. Like I said, our rivers and lakes are really at breaking point. Our climate emissions from agriculture are huge. It's the biggest climate emitter in the country. And we need to start reducing those emissions. And we know that we can do that in a way that is not going to be, break break the bank for farmers. We know that we can do that in a profitable way, and we can plan for it now by making that a sinking cap and over time getting it down to zero.
Right, so that cap is effectively not much of a cap at all.
Yes, that's right.
So what is Greenpeace hoping to achieve with this petition? I noticed the specific language of phasing out, which signals to me that this isn't something you expect to happen overnight.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it would be unreasonable to suggest that farmers could would be able to just stop using this with no support tomorrow. And that's why, you know, we're taking a more reasonable approach to say, right, well, we need to phase it out. But the outcome is still the same. It needs to go from agriculture in New Zealand. We can't keep telling the world we're clean and green while using this incredibly harmful chemical in our farming systems. We've got one of the highest rates of use of it in the world. So, yeah, it's pretty out of control and needs to come down. We've been campaigning for this phase out for about 2 years. And as we were talking about before, last April, we managed to get that first cap into regulation, which was a real win, even though it's very high. But moving forward, we need to keep pressuring the political parties to ensure that they are looking after our health and the health of our environment, because ultimately that's connected to our health anyway. And they need to be putting that over the profits of... you know, prioritising that over the profits of the agrochemical companies that are selling this product. Our health is much more important than how big their bank accounts are. So we'll continue campaigning for this phase out.
The timing of this petition is quite interesting because this morning news came out that Fonterra has been dumping nitrate-heavy wastewater. What are some of the risks to nitrate-polluting water, and does Greenpeace have a response to the Fonterra situation?
Yeah, very much so. So nitrate pollution, which comes from synthetic nitrogen fertiliser and other sources, like wastewater from dairy processing and also the urine of livestock, it carries with it human health risks. So at about 11 milligrams per litre, which is the human health limit, it is very risky for pregnant women and bottle-fed babies. It can be fatal. But at rates way lower than that, so down to 1 milligram per litre, 11 times lower than that, where there's also increasing evidence showing that that is linked to an increased risk of bowel cancer. And New Zealand has one of the highest rates of bowel cancer in the world, funnily enough, and Canterbury and Southland, where a huge amount of dairy intensification has happened over the last 3 decades, have some of the highest rates in New Zealand. It's very concerning that that currently in New Zealand, our government allows pollution to be 11 times higher what new evidence is showing could be risking colorectal or bowel cancer if it's consumed. So that's the human health risks that we are having to take because of the use of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer and the really weak regulatory situation that we've got that is allowing Fonterra to put, I think it was up to, they've got up to consent to put up to 400 to 600 kilograms of nitrogen pollution, of nitrogen onto their farms, and that's turning into pollution in groundwater. And we know that people are consuming that sometimes unknowingly without having had their water tested.
All right, so lastly, just before I let you go, I wanted to touch on the agriculture sector at large, as they're a pretty large source of emissions. So what changes need to be made to the sector in order for it to be sustainable into the future?
So when it comes to climate pollution from agriculture, it's a really simple equation. The two main sources of that climate pollution are the number of cows and sheep, and the amount of synthetic nitrogen fertilizer used. So those are the two sources of methane and nitrous oxide emissions. So the simple solution is to have fewer cows and to phase out synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. And as a country, we need to, if we're going to play our part in, the fight against climate change, we need to accept that we are going to have to produce less dairy. We are going to need to convert land away from dairy and into other things that sequester carbon rather than emit it. So that doesn't mean stopping farming or stopping producing food. It just means changing what we're producing. So rather than dairy, we need to be looking at horticulture. We need to be looking at other high-value timbers and other high-value food products, such as some of the plant-based foods that are really gaining traction in our export markets anyway. And we're not saying we shouldn't be farming any cows, but whatever we are farming needs to be a lot. There needs to be a lot fewer cows farmed, and the way we're farming it needs to radically change. We can't be using synthetic fertilizer. We can't be using PKE that's driving deforestation. We need to be stocking our farms at a rate the land can naturally sustain, and a rate that's not causing major water and climate pollution. And it's economically sensible for us to do that. The growth in plant-based foods, the growth in organic foods, the value of those in our export markets is exponential. It's huge. We can be looking after our rivers. We can be rebuilding biodiversity and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and even sequestering carbon on our farms, and also be providing good livelihoods for New Zealand farmers and for New Zealanders. Through shifting away from this really industrial model of dairy farming that we're currently stuck in.
That was Jen Toop from Greenpeace NZ.
The government has indicated
The Wire.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Amidst the mess that was 2020 and may well be 2021, 95BFM underwent a trek up north over the weekend to commemorate the 181st anniversary of the signing of Te Tiriti o Waitangi. On February 6th, 1840, around 40 rangatira and representatives of the British Crown signed what would be the founding document of Aotearoa New Zealand, with one version in English and the other in Te Reo. Te Tiriti was a document that declared Māori rangatiratanga, or sovereignty, yet also the treaty declared ultimate sovereignty to Queen Victoria. You can already see where this starts to get confusing. Ultimately, Te Tiriti is one of the causes for a number of disputes, conflict, intergenerational trauma, poverty and inequality that Māori face in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In heading up to the Waitangi Treaty Grounds, I had one question in mind. Should Waitangi Day be a day of commemoration, or a day where grievances are laid to bear, or both? I wanted kōrero with everyday, ordinary people instead of politicians that the media tend to glorify on this day. I asked how people were feeling about the day, how they felt the vibes were around the treaty grounds, and whether or not we should move on as a nation, focus on the past, or both. Firstly, I spoke to a stallholder in one of the many marketplaces around the area.
So we're just wondering how you feel about Waitangi Day, how you're feeling about today, and just how you feel about Waitangi in general.
I don't really know like too much in depth about the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I know about the history and bits, but I feel okay about it. I'm having a good day.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good way for lots of different cultures to come together and just celebrate being together, especially with COVID and everything.
Yeah. Absolutely. Do you feel like the vibes here are more happy or more angry and grief?
Everyone's been happy.
Yeah.
And really like, not welcoming, but just happy, I suppose.
Yeah.
Whatever's in the
news. How do events like Waitangi Day help you as someone who's running a small business?
So this is our first time here, probably only our third horse market we've ever done, and I think it's good. We really just do this and enjoy coming out and being a part of different communities. Yeah.
Awesome.
Waitangi brought in people of all backgrounds, cultures, different perspectives and agendas. Protests began as early as the conclusion of the dawn service when a wahine jumped out of the crowd and passionately criticised the ceremony, claiming that we cannot commemorate when Māori are still overrepresented in homelessness, poverty and prison, and I am inclined to agree. Not too much later than that, two individuals spent a large part of the day reading out the names of every rangatira who had refused to sign Te Tiriti. Amidst this protest, I spoke to a representative from Te Wānanga or Aotearoa.
How are you finding the general mood around today? Is everyone quite happy, or is there quite a lot of grief surrounding? How are you finding the vibe here at Waitangi today?
It's not as busy just due to COVID.
Yep.
People aren't sure. But I haven't been back to Waitangi for like 5 years, so I've come back this year and it's just growing. It's not a holiday to drink alcohol and just do whatever you want to do. It actually means a lot more, particularly to our younger generation.
So do you feel... what does Waitangi mean to you? When someone asks you, what is Waitangi Day, how would you answer that?
It's just a day to remember what's happened and what's in front of us and what is our future going to look like for our kids and my own children.
So do you think we should be focusing on the past or looking forward or a mix of both?
I think you just have to acknowledge the past but definitely move forward.
Yeah.
Because a lot of our kids, a lot of our mukapuna and just people in general are taking the time out to remember Waitangi and what it stands for.
As I said before, the Waitangi Treaty Grounds were a mashup of all sorts of people and groups, with each presence being important one way or the other. Rainbow Youth made its first Waitangi appearance this year, an important step in LGBTQ+, and in particular, takatāpuhi activism. I spoke to a few reps from Rainbow Youth, and particularly asked about the importance of LGBTQ+ presence at Waitangi.
So, how have you found the vibes here at Waitangi today? Has it been quite a happy, like, pleasant experience, or has there been some grief and anger displayed as well?
So this is our first year at Waitangi actually, so hopefully we'll be coming back for the next few years. But it's actually been great. We've been having a mean amount of kōrero with a bunch of whānau here. The kōrero's really gone.
Yeah, super inclusive, friendly. The vibe's so nice and chill this year.
Yeah.
It's been nice chatting to everyone.
How important is it to you to have a Rainbow Youth presence here at Waitangi Day, where you've got such a mashup of different, you know, people with all sorts of backgrounds? How important is it that we have LGBT representation here as well?
Oh, that's such a great question. Oh, so important. We don't have enough. We want heaps of support for our takatāpuhi whānau, and we are here to help represent them and give them a space to feel like they're also loved amongst our community. Absolutely.
Yeah, really, I also agree. I think it's really important. But the really cool thing about being here is everyone's been so friendly, coming up to us, talking about the mahi we do and how important it is for their community. So we've had a really good response, which is encouraging as well.
When you hear the term Waitangi Day, how does it make you feel? Does it make you feel like a commemorative mood or a mood where, you know, there's a lot of grief? How do you personally feel about the term Waitangi Day?
Personally, I feel like it's always a mixed bag of feelings. It's like mostly always like commemorative and remembering our past. But it's meant to be here today in the present with such great attitudes around. So
yeah. And as a Pākehā person, I think over my lifetime the definition of it has really changed. So it used to just be a day we had off. And as I've grown older and gone through like my own learning, I now see it as a day to celebrate. For people to celebrate their Māoridom and what it means to be Māori in Ngā Tearoa, and also acknowledge the grievance and the hardship sometimes that goes along with that.
Yeah. Great, thank you so much. You're really, really...
As a Māori, I felt it was important that these perspectives were told. While for many, Waitangi Day is a day where Māori grievances are unleashed, the individuals that I spoke to see Waitangi Day as an opportunity to celebrate being together wherever we come from, and I'm inclined to agree. However, the romanticized commemorative messages spoken by the people at the top as moving on as, quote, one nation, as spoken at the dawn service, do not change the fact that millions of acres of Māori land confiscated and bought at the hands of the Crown have not yet been returned or properly compensated. Politicians talking about how much we have progressed in terms of unity and peace does not change the fact that our tūpuna had our reo beaten and shamed out of them. Pākehā speakers talking about how New Zealand can be a beacon of light in a messy world does not change the fact that Māori represent over 50% of the prison population. Being told to move on does not change the fact that the John Bankses of the country can call our tikanga a Stone Age culture and Māori as people that will come in through your window. Being told that New Zealand isn't racist doesn't get rid of the shaking experiences of being followed around a shop or having someone clutch their bag as they walk past you. February 6th, 1840 is a date that creates a number of emotions for people. My goal as a 95 BFM journalist was to make sure that the ordinary everyday person was listened to and acknowledged in their perspective on a day that conjures a number of conflicting emotions. It is, however, a day that brings people of all backgrounds together with good kai, good music, and a good time. And because of that, should be celebrated while acknowledging the racial problems New Zealand faces today. Be right back after this.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Nothing says summer like the smell of sunscreen, a picnic on the beach, crisp salad, succulent dip, and the best organic sourdough either side of the Bombays. Bread and Butter make real sourdough, supporting organic practices with New Zealand-grown grains and the best locally supplied ingredients. Bread and Butter, for bread that's better. Three stores across Auckland, Grayland, Milford and Ponsonby. And coming soon to the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
No idea.
Okay, what about treasure trunks in six?
What does that even mean?
Shit, you're useless. Don't you know anything?
I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club, there's a tribute to Caetano Veloso with support from Chip Matthews and Junior.
Oh, and tomorrow?
Havana Groove Live with support from Ben Morrison, Luke King and Ricky Kahi.
Sweet as. One of those actually sold 13 across.
Cheers. Same old Ponsonby Social Club. 152 Ponsonby Road.
Zero emissions, no parking hassles, no traffic. Make your commute fun.
Get on a scooter at Freed, West Haven Drive, your micro-mobility e-scooter specialist.
Freed Electric Scooters is the place to go for all your e-scootering needs. Their full-service workshop covers all brands of e-scooters, plus they're the exclusive agent for top-of-the-line zero electric scooters.
Freed Electric Scooters, fun, safe and easy to ride. Find out more at freedpev.co.nz.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
Our February playlist features Sarah Mary Chadwick, Jasmine Mary, Here Lies Man, Sophie featuring Autica, and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
Brooke was unfortunately unable to join us today, but filling in for her is her pal Dave. I spoke to ACT leader David Seymour about housing and sick leave.
I wanted to ask you about this release regarding the Reserve Bank and house prices, but to be completely honest, I don't really understand what it's all about. So what is the significance of this?
Yeah, look, thanks for asking. And can I just take you back to last year, Adrian Orr, the Reserve Bank Governor, came to a select committee in Parliament. And this was around the time of COVID. The Reserve Bank was saying it was basically going to print a lot of money, tens if not hundreds of billions of extra New Zealand dollars pumped into the economy. And I said to Adrian Orr, the Reserve Bank Governor, do you realise what that's going to do to asset prices? Because we'd already seen it happen before. After the GFC, we had quantitative easing all around the world, just about everywhere except New Zealand. New Zealand kept conventional monetary policy, but the UK, the US, just about everybody printed trillions and trillions of their currency. And what happened is that asset prices went through the roof. Shares had a 10-year boom. Housing prices had a 10-year boom, and the political reaction was a whole lot of people said, actually, this is unfair. The rich have gotten richer. The poor have stood still at best, and it seems more important to own a piece of paper, such as a share certificate or a property title, than it does to work hard. And you saw the political reaction to that.
Your release indicates this situation was supposedly entirely predictable. Is that right?
Oh, it is. And I don't want to try and blow my own trumpet, but I predicted it in that exchange with Adrian Orr, which I think probably would have been maybe last March, just as COVID was kicking in.
There's this concern here that the true solution to the housing issue is improvements to supply, as you've stated, whereas you're saying the government has been focusing too much on changes to the demand side of things. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, happy to. Look, I think if you analyse a lot of the government's policies, it's about government building social housing, it's about changing the tenancy laws, it's about giving people, you know, first home grants, or at least that was the previous government. And when you put all of those sort of demand side solutions together, oh, and it's also about changing the rules for investors. But all of those actually mean there's more houses. They just change the rules about who's likely to get them and who's likely to live in them. And maybe that's a worthwhile policy objective. Different governments, of course, have different groups they want to prioritise. The ACT Party just makes the point that ultimately the real solution is to more homes, so we don't have to make these difficult trade-offs. And I talk a lot to people in the property development industry, and they just have impossible difficulties. I'll just give you one tiny example that circulated about a year, 18 months ago now. Somebody did an expose on what it takes to name a street in a new subdivision. And it turns out there's 19 steps. You've got to go to the council, you've got to consult the community. And ultimately, you know, if somebody wants to do a subdivision and call a new street, you know, Dickhead Place, well, I think that's pretty silly. But I actually don't think it's the biggest problem we have right now. And I actually don't think it's very likely to happen anyway. So why put people through 19 steps? Because if that's how difficult it is to name a street, imagine building the street, imagine laying out the subdivision, getting the loans and zoned. So, you know, there's just too many difficulties in developing property, and that's why people ultimately are paying more, because the cost you pay for a home is always going to be, linked to what is the price of bringing on new supply.
So what is ACT's strategy for addressing housing issues in New Zealand?
I've got to go deep and really diagnose the problem by diving into the data. And our approach is to say, well, look, what's happened is over the last 30 years, just take Auckland, since this is BFM, we've had a 900% increase in the price of a section over 30 years. Now, the per square metre building cost has gone up 262%, and inflation has gone up 60%. So building costs have gone up, and there are problems with the cost of actually building houses. But the real clue is that 900% increase in the cost of new sections in Auckland. I mean, you know, new sections in Auckland have gone up almost as fast as Apple stocks over that time.
So lastly, I just want to briefly touch on sick leave. The government has introduced a new payment that essentially subsidises sick leave for people waiting for COVID test results. Sorry, I just bumped my microphone. Do you think that's a positive change?
I do. It's really good economics. It's really good policy. So if you look at what's the problem we're trying to solve here, a person who may be feeling ill, is also, you know, worried about losing their income, don't want to take a day off, their boss, you know, says, well, look, we can't afford to pay you. As a New Zealand taxpayer, I'm more than happy to pay that person to stay home for a couple of days, get tested. Probably chances are they actually don't have it, but I'm happy to pay them to do so, because if that prevents an outbreak, it's going to save the New Zealand economy and me as a taxpayer probably billions of dollars. So it's really smart policy. I one criticism. The government last year extended sick leave by 5 days, saying it was part of the COVID response. Well, I think that was a lie. The correct response to COVID is to have a policy for people who have COVID or are suspected of having COVID, compensate them to stay home. What the government actually did was give an extra 5 days sick leave to 2.6 million workers who overwhelmingly don't have COVID. And I just think sometimes, you know, we need a bit of honesty in politics. If you have a policy for a particular reason, you should say. You certainly shouldn't hijack important issues that people care about, such as preventing COVID.
To me, that response of extending the sick leave by 5 days seemed more to me like a recognition of the fact that health had become a very publicly important issue rather than a direct response to COVID.
I guess if you want to make the link that loose, then you could justify just about anything. But I would go back to real problem diagnosis, and I'd ask, was there actually a problem that people were going to work sick because of a limited amount of sick leave in the law? And I read the regulatory impact statements and the documentation that they produced along with that legislation, and nowhere did it show that there's a real problem there. It argued that people are taking, I think, more sick leave than they used to, but not that there's actually an epidemic of people going to work sick because of our current laws. So, you know, you can make the argument, well, we care more about health, so we give people more sick leave. When government makes a law, it imposes costs on people, in this case on employers, and I think if we want to be able to do the things that we really aim for, and I'll just give you one example because I get a lot of it, people who want more pharmaceuticals to be funded, then we need to be really cautious about the laws we make and the costs they impose on business and job growth.
That was ACT Party leader and fifth place Dancing with the Stars competitor David Seymour.
And it is odd for somebody to pay you $100 for a photo of your feet. That is not normal behaviour.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
That brings us to the end of the show. Big thanks to all of those who spoke to us. David Seymour, Jen Toop, and all those people that Katanama spoke to at Waitangi Day, as well as, always, Marcus Jones, filling in for the third week in a row at Dear Science. What a legend. Also, big thanks to all of you who tuned in, called us, and sent texts. We'll be back next week. Up next is Bridge with the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.